Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Codependent No More, How to Stop Controlling Others and Start Caring for Yourself, by Melody Beatty. Narrated by Christina Moore and directed by Greta Byram. This book is copyrighted 1987 and 1992 by Hazelden Foundation. This recording is copyrighted 2005 by Recorded Books. Is someone else's problem your problem? If, like so many others, you've lost sight of your own life in the drama of tending to someone else's, you may be codependent. And you may find yourself in this book. And now, Codependent No More.
Preface to the 1992 edition. Back in the early 80s, when I first envisioned writing a book about codependency, when I was desperately struggling to sort through my own pain, I vowed that if I ever figured out what happened to me and what I needed to do to get better, I'd write a book about it. That book, I decided, would be warm, gentle, non-judgmental, non-technical. It would be kind, because that's what I needed, information and kindness. I needed help with my healing process from my codependency issues. About 5 years later, I sat down to write that book. Just separated from my husband of 10 years, I went on welfare for 4 months to help me support myself and my two children, Nicole and Shane, while I wrote Codependent No More. When I wondered how I, a non-expert, could write a book like that, I took comfort by telling myself that it was okay to say what I thought because only a few people would read it anyway. I also spent a great deal of time on the introduction, striving not only to introduce the book, but to introduce the concept of codependency, the word, to a world that, for the most part, had not heard about it. Now, another 5 years later, I've been asked to write an anniversary preface to a book that has sold over 2 million copies. "What do I put in it?" I asked my editor and friend, Rebecca Post, from Hazelden. "Tell about the changes that have happened to women, to people in our country, to you, since you wrote that book," she suggested. I pondered. "What changes have happened besides the Persian Gulf War, the breakdown of communism in the Soviet Union, and the Hill-Thomas hearings?" I turn on the television. The movie of the week, I can't remember the name, is a story about a teenager struggling to deal with her alcoholism and the impact of being raped. Her mother, a nurse, has worked valiantly to break free from a dysfunctional and abusive relationship with her husband, the girl's father. Throughout the movie, mother and daughter talk directly about not rescuing each other because of the diminishing effects of such behavior. The movie ends with the daughter playing a guitar and singing a song she's written about not being a victim anymore. I walk into a church, one I haven't attended for a long time. The sermon is somewhat unusual this cold Sunday winter morning. The minister is speaking from his heart, telling the congregation that he is done leading a church that's based on shame, fear, guilt, and dishonesty. He wants instead, he says, to be part of a church that's based on equality, honesty, intimacy, acceptance, and the healing power of God's love. He wants to be part of a church where he can have his own issues and problems and where people are functioning in healthy, honest relationships with each other and God. My daughter comes home from her first week at a new school. "Guess what, Mom," she says. "We're reading a meditation each day in homeroom class from your book, The Language of Letting Go. And at my friend's school, they're talking about codependency issues in health class." Codependent No More, with a picture of handcuffs broken apart on the front cover, makes the bestseller list in France. Cat Dependent No More, parodying the title of my book, makes the 1991 Christmas book list here in Minnesota. Some things have changed. I've written 4 more books, traveled the world, divorced but not remarried, and paid back the welfare department for the financial help they gave me. I feel more passionately about the importance of healing from our abuse issues. I feel more passionately. I've become more spontaneous, embraced my femininity, and learned new lessons along the way about boundaries, flexibility, and owning my power. And about love. I'm learning to respect men. My relationships have deepened. Some have changed. The most significant change in my life has been the loss of my son, Shane. As you may have heard or read, in February of 1991, 3 days after his 12th birthday, my beloved Shane, so much a part of my life and work, was killed suddenly in a ski accident on the slopes at Afton Alps. I'm learning about death and life. I've grown and changed. I've watched my friends grow and change. Many of you have written to me about your growth and change. I still struggle with feeling feelings and trusting my process, my path, and my higher power. I still feel afraid at times. Sometimes I forget and try to control everything. I may become obsessive unless I catch myself. And despite its years on the bestseller list, the most common question I'm still asked by people and the media is, just exactly what is codependency? Some things haven't changed, at least not a lot. I still refuse to be an expert and permanently decline the title of guru. But I'm still willing to tell you what I see and believe. Although some things appear not to have changed, things are constantly changing. Our consciousness, as individuals and as a society, has been raised. We've realized that women have souls and men have feelings. And I've gone deeper into my healing process than I ever intended. I don't know how much my writing has contributed to this consciousness raising and how much the consciousness raising has contributed to my writing, but I'm grateful to be part of what's happened. I'm honored to be part of a movement influenced by people such as Ann Wilson Schaaf, John Bradshaw, Patrick Carnes, Ernie Larson, and led by people such as you, my readers, the real heroes, quietly and profoundly doing your own healing work and carrying the message to others, most significantly by example. I've met many of you in my travels across the country. Some of you have written to me. Thank you for the love, support, and compassion you've shown me, not only over the years, but throughout the rough, raw months of 1991 after Shane's death. Many of you have written to me saying how much I've helped you. Well, you've helped and touched me, too. One woman wrote to me recently saying she had read all my books and had been recovering from codependency for years. "I want to learn more, though," she wrote. "I want to go deeper into my codependency. Please write more about that." Maybe we don't need to go deeper into our codependency. We can instead march forward into our destinies. We can remember and practice all we've learned about addictions, codependency, and abuse. With compassion and boundaries, we need to commit fully to loving God, ourselves, and others. We need to commit fully to trusting God, ourselves, and our process. Then we can be open to the next step. We are on time, and we are where we need to be. We can be trusted. So can God. And letting go and gratitude still work. Keep your head up and your heart open, and let's see what's next. Happy 5-year anniversary. Codependent no more. Melody Beatty. Introduction. My first encounter with codependence occurred in the early 60s. This was before people tormented by other people's behavior were called codependents, and before people addicted to alcohol and other drugs were labeled chemically dependent. Although I didn't know what codependents were, I usually knew who they were. As an alcoholic and addict, I stormed through life, helping create other codependents. Codependents were a necessary nuisance. They were hostile, controlling, manipulative, indirect, guilt-producing, difficult to communicate with, generally disagreeable, sometimes downright hateful, and a hindrance to my compulsion to get high. They hollered at me, hid my pills, made nasty faces at me, poured my alcohol down the sink, tried to keep me from getting more drugs, wanted to know why I was doing this to them, and asked what was wrong with me. But they were always there, ready to rescue me from self-created disasters. The codependence in my life didn't understand me, and the misunderstanding was mutual. I didn't understand me, and I didn't understand them. My first professional encounter with codependence occurred years later, in 1976. At that time in Minnesota, addicts and alcoholics had become chemically dependent. Their families and friends had become significant others, and I had become a recovering addict and alcoholic. By then, I also worked as a counselor in the chemical dependency field, that vast network of institutions, programs, and agencies that helps chemically dependent people get well. Because I'm a woman, and most of the significant others at that time were women, and because I had the least seniority and none of my coworkers wanted to do it, my employer at the Minneapolis Treatment Center told me to organize support groups for wives of addicts in the program. I wasn't prepared for this task. I still found codependents hostile, controlling, manipulative, indirect, guilt-producing, difficult to communicate with, and more. In my group, I saw people who felt responsible for the entire world, but they refused to take responsibility for leading and living their own lives. I saw people who constantly gave to others, but didn't know how to receive. I saw people give until they were angry, exhausted, and emptied of everything. I saw some give until they gave up. I even saw one woman give and suffer so much that she died of old age and natural causes at age 33. She was the mother of 5 children and the wife of an alcoholic who had been sent to prison for the 3rd time. I worked with women who were experts at taking care of everyone around them, yet these women doubted their ability to take care of themselves. I saw mere shells of people racing mindlessly from one activity to another. I saw people-pleasers, martyrs, stoics, tyrants, withering vines, clinging vines, and, borrowing from H. Sackler's line in his play The Great White Hope, pinched-up faces giving off the miseries. Most codependents were obsessed with other people. With great precision and detail, they could recite long lists of the addict's deeds and misdeeds, what he or she thought, felt, did, and said, and what he or she didn't think, feel, do, and say. The codependents knew what the alcoholic or addict should and shouldn't do, and they wondered extensively why he or she did or didn't do it. Yet these codependents, who had such great insights into others, couldn't see themselves. They didn't know what they were feeling. They weren't sure what they thought. And they didn't know what, if anything, they could do to solve their problems, if indeed they had any problems other than the alcoholics. It was a formidable group, these codependents. They were aching, complaining, and trying to control everyone and everything but themselves. And, except for a few quiet pioneers in family therapy, many counselors, including me, didn't know how to help them. The chemical dependency field was flourishing, but help focused on the addict. Literature and training on family therapy were scarce. What did codependents need? What did they want? Weren't they just an extension of the alcoholic, a visitor to the treatment center? Why couldn't they cooperate instead of always making problems? The alcoholic had an excuse for being so crazy. He was drunk. These significant others had no excuse. They were this way sober. Soon, I subscribed to 2 popular beliefs. These crazy codependents, significant others, are sicker than the alcoholics. And no wonder the alcoholic drinks. Who wouldn't with a crazy spouse like that? By then, I had been sober for a while. I was beginning to understand myself, but I didn't understand codependency. I tried, but couldn't. Until years later, when I became so caught up in the chaos of a few alcoholics that I stopped living my own life. I stopped thinking. I stopped feeling positive emotions, and I was left with rage, bitterness, hatred, fear, depression, helplessness, despair, and guilt. At times, I wanted to stop living. I had no energy. I spent most of my time worrying about people and trying to figure out how to control them. I couldn't say no to anything but fun activities if my life depended on it, which it did. My relationships with friends and family members were in shambles. I felt terribly victimized. I lost myself and didn't know how it had happened. I didn't know what had happened. I thought I was going crazy. And I thought, shaking a finger at the people around me, it's their fault. Sadly, aside from myself, nobody knew how badly I felt. My problems were my secret. Unlike the alcoholics and other troubled people in my life, I wasn't going around making big messes and expecting someone to clean up after me. In fact, next to the alcoholics, I looked good. I was so responsible, so dependable. Sometimes I wasn't sure I had a problem. I knew I felt miserable, but I didn't understand why my life wasn't working. After floundering in despair for a while, I began to understand. Like many people who judge others harshly, I realized I had just taken a very long and painful walk in the shoes of those I had judged. I now understood those crazy codependents. I had become one. Gradually, I began to climb out of my black abyss. Along the way, I developed a passionate interest in the subject of codependency. As a counselor, although I no longer worked full-time in the field, I still considered myself one, and as a writer, my curiosity was provoked. As a flaming, careening codependent, a phrase borrowed from an Al-Anon member, who needed help, I also had a personal stake in the subject. What happens to people like me? How does it happen? Why? Most important, what do codependents need to do to feel better and stay that way? I talked to counselors, therapists, and codependents. I read the few available books on the subject and related topics. I reread the basics, the therapy books that have stood the test of time, looking for ideas that applied. I went to meetings of Al-Anon, a self-help group based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, but geared toward the person who has been affected by another person's drinking. Eventually, I found what I was seeking. I began to see, understand, and change. My life started working again. Soon, I was conducting another group for codependents at another Minneapolis treatment center, but this time, I had a vague notion of what I was doing. I still found codependents hostile, controlling, manipulative, indirect, and all the things I had found them before. I still saw all the peculiar twists of personality I previously saw. But I saw deeper. I saw people who were hostile. They had felt so much hurt that hostility was their only defense against being crushed again. They were that angry because anyone who had tolerated what they had would be that angry. They were controlling because everything around them and inside them was out of control. Always, the dam of their lives and the lives of those around them threatened to burst and spew harmful consequences on everyone, and nobody but them seemed to notice or care. I saw people who manipulated because manipulation appeared to be the only way to get anything done. I worked with people who were indirect because the systems they lived in seemed incapable of tolerating honesty. I worked with people who thought they were going crazy because they had believed so many lies they didn't know what reality was. I saw people who had gotten so absorbed in other people's problems they didn't have time to identify or solve their own. These were people who had cared so deeply, and often destructively, about other people that they had forgotten how to care about themselves. The codependents felt responsible for so much because the people around them felt responsible for so little. They were just taking up the slack. I saw hurting, confused people who needed comfort, understanding, and information. I saw victims of alcoholism who didn't drink but were nonetheless victimized by alcohol. I saw victims struggling desperately to gain some kind of power over their perpetrators. They learned from me, and I learned from them. Soon, I began to subscribe to some new beliefs about codependency. Codependents aren't crazier or sicker than alcoholics, but they hurt as much or more. They haven't cornered the market on agony, but they have gone through their pain without the anesthetizing effects of alcohol or other drugs, or the other high states achieved by people with compulsive disorders. And the pain that comes from loving someone who's in trouble can be profound. The chemically dependent partner numbs the feelings, and the non-abuser is doubled over in pain, relieved only by anger and occasional fantasies, wrote Janet Geringer Woitetz in an article from the book Codependency, an Emerging Issue. Codependents are that way sober because they went through what they did sober. No wonder codependents are so crazy. Who wouldn't be after living with the people they've lived with? It's been difficult for codependents to get the information and practical help they need and deserve. It's tough enough to convince alcoholics or other disturbed people to seek help. It's more difficult to convince codependents, those who by comparison look but don't feel normal, that they have problems. Codependents suffered in the backdrop of the sick person. If they recovered, they did that in the background too. Until recently, many counselors, like me, didn't know what to do to help them. Sometimes codependents were blamed, sometimes they were ignored, sometimes they were expected to magically shape up, an archaic attitude that has not worked with alcoholics and doesn't help codependents either. Rarely were codependents treated as individuals who needed help to get better. Rarely were they given a personalized recovery program for their problems and their pain. Yet by its nature, alcoholism and other compulsive disorders turn everyone affected by the illness into victims. People who need help even if they are not drinking, using other drugs, gambling, overeating, or overdoing a compulsion. That's why I wrote this book. It grew out of my research, my personal and professional experiences, and my passion for the subject. It is a personal and, in some places, prejudiced opinion. I'm not an expert, and this isn't a technical book for experts. Whether the person you've let yourself be affected by is an alcoholic, gambler, foodaholic, workaholic, sexaholic, criminal, rebellious teenager, neurotic parent, another codependent, or any combination of the above, this book is for you, the codependent. This book is not about how you can help your alcoholic or troubled person, although if you get better, his or her chance of recovery improves too. There are plenty of good books on how to help the alcoholic. This book is about your most important and probably most neglected responsibility, taking care of yourself. It's about what you can do to start feeling better. I've tried to round up some of the best, most helpful thoughts on codependency. I've included quotes from people I consider experts to demonstrate their beliefs. I've also included case histories to show how people dealt with particular problems. Although I've changed names and certain details to protect privacy, all case histories are true and are not composites. I've inserted endnotes to document information, to suggest additional reading, and to attribute material to appropriate sources. But much of what I've learned has been from many people and their similar thoughts on this subject. Many ideas have been handed down and passed around, and their sources have become indistinguishable. I've tried to attribute accurately, but in this field, that is not always possible. Although this is a self-help, how-to book, please remember it's not a cookbook for mental health. Each person is unique. Each situation is unique. Try to tap into your own healing process. That may include seeking professional help, attending self-help groups, such as Al-Anon, and calling on the assistance of a power greater than yourself. A friend, Scott Eggleston, who is a professional in the mental health field, told me a therapy fable. He heard it from someone who heard it from someone else. It goes, "Once upon a time, a woman moved to a cave in the mountains to study with a guru. She wanted, she said, to learn everything there was to know. The guru supplied her with stacks of books and left her alone so she could study. Every morning, the guru returned to the cave to monitor the woman's progress. In his hand, he carried a heavy wooden cane. Each morning, he asked her the same question. Have you learned everything there is to know yet? Each morning, her answer was the same. No, she said, I haven't. The guru would then strike her over the head with his cane. This scenario repeated itself for months. One day, the guru entered the cave, asked the same question, heard the same answer, and raised his cane to hit her in the same way. But the woman grabbed the cane from the guru, stopping his assault in midair. Relieved to end the daily batterings, but fearing reprisal, the woman looked up at the guru. To her surprise, the guru smiled. Congratulations, he said. You have graduated. You now know everything you need to know. How's that? The woman asked. You have learned that you will never learn everything there is to know, he replied. And you have learned how to stop the pain. That's what this book is about. Stopping the pain and gaining control of your life. Many people have learned to do it. You can too.
Part 1. What's codependency, and who's got it? Chapter 1. Jessica's story. Georgianne, who is married to an alcoholic, says, "The sun was shining, and it was a beautiful day when I met him. Then everything went crazy." This is Jessica's story. I'll let her tell it. I sat in the kitchen, drinking coffee, thinking about my unfinished housework. Dishes, dusting, laundry. The list was endless, yet I couldn't get started. It was too much to think about. Doing it seemed impossible. Just like my life, I thought. Fatigue, a familiar feeling, overtook me. I headed for the bedroom. Once a luxury, naps had become a necessity. Sleeping was about all I could do. Where had my motivation gone? I used to have an excess of energy. Now it was an effort to comb my hair and apply makeup daily, an effort I frequently didn't put forth. I lay on my bed and fell into a deep sleep. When I awoke, my first thoughts and feelings were painful. This also was not new. I wasn't sure which hurt most, the raw ache I felt because I was certain my marriage was over. The love was gone, extinguished by the lies and the drinking and the disappointments and the financial problems. The bitter rage I felt toward my husband, the man who had caused it all. The despair I felt because God, whom I had trusted, had betrayed me by allowing this to happen. Or the mixture of fear, helplessness, and hopelessness that blended into all the other emotions. Damn him, I thought. Why did he have to drink? Why couldn't he have sobered up earlier? Why did he have to lie? Why couldn't he have loved me as much as I had loved him? Why didn't he stop drinking and lying years ago, when I still cared? I never intended to marry an alcoholic. My father had been one. I had tried so hard to carefully choose my husband. Great choice. Frank's problem with drinking had become apparent on our honeymoon when he left our hotel suite late one afternoon and didn't return until 6:30 the next morning. Why didn't I see then? Looking back, the signs were clear. What a fool I had been. Oh, no, he's not an alcoholic. Not him, I had defended time and again. I had believed his lies. I had believed my lies. Why didn't I just leave him, get a divorce? Guilt, fear, lack of initiative, and indecision. Besides, I had left him before. When we were apart, all I did was feel depressed, think about him, and worry about money. Damn me. I looked at the clock. 3:15. The kids would soon be home from school. Then he would be home, expecting supper. No housework done today. Nothing ever got done. And it's his fault, I thought. His fault. Suddenly, I shifted emotional gears. Was my husband really at work? Maybe he had taken another woman to lunch. Maybe he was having an affair. Maybe he had left early to drink. Maybe he was at work, creating problems there. How long would he have this job, anyway? Another week? another month. Then he'd quit or be fired, as usual. The phone rang, interrupting my anxiety. It was a neighbor, a friend. We talked, and I told her about my day. "I'm going to Al-Anon tomorrow," she said. "Want to come along?" I had heard about Al-Anon. It was a group for people married to drunks. Visions charged into my mind of the little women huddled at this meeting, making the most of their husbands' drinking, forgiving them, and thinking of little ways to help them. "I'll see," I lied. "I've got a lot of work to do," I explained, not lying. Outrage poured through me, and I barely heard the rest of our conversation. Of course I didn't want to go to Al-Anon. I had helped and helped. Hadn't I already done enough for him? I felt furious at the suggestion that I do more and continue giving to this bottomless pit of unmet needs we called a marriage. I was sick of shouldering the burden and feeling responsible for the success or failure of the relationship. "It's his problem," I railed silently. "Let him find his solution. Leave me out of this. Don't ask another thing of me. Just make him better, and I'll feel better." After I hung up the phone, I dragged myself into the kitchen to fix supper. "Anyway, I'm not the one that needs help," I thought. "I haven't drank, used drugs, lost jobs, and lied to and deceived those I loved. I've held this family together, sometimes by the skin of my teeth. I've paid the bills, maintained a home on a scant budget, been there for every emergency, and, married to an alcoholic, there had been plenty of emergencies, gone through most bad times alone, and worried to the point of frequent illness. No," I decided, "I'm not the irresponsible one. To the contrary, I've been responsible for everything and everyone. There was nothing wrong with me. I just needed to get going, start doing my daily chores. I didn't need meetings to do that. I'd just feel guilty if I went out when I had all this work to do at home. God knows I didn't need more guilt. Tomorrow, I'd get up and get busy. Things will be better. Tomorrow." When the kids came home, I found myself hollering at them. That didn't surprise them or me. My husband was easygoing, the good guy. I was the bitch. I tried to be pleasant, but it was hard. Anger was always just beneath the surface. For so long, I had tolerated so much. I was no longer willing or able to tolerate anything. I was always on the defensive, and I felt like I was, somehow, fighting for my life. Later, I learned I was. By the time my husband came home, I had put a disinterested effort into preparing supper. We ate, barely talking. "I had a good day," Frank said. "What does that mean?" I wondered. "What did you really do? Were you even at work? Furthermore, who cares?" "That's nice," I said back. "How was your day?" he asked. "How in the hell do you think it was?" I railed silently. "After all you've done to me, how do you expect me to have any day?" I flashed him daggers, forced a smile, and said, "My day was okay. Thanks for asking." Frank looked away. He heard what I wasn't saying, more than what I had said. He knew better than to say anything else. I did, too. We were usually one step away from a raving argument, a recount of past offenses, and screamed threats of divorce. We used to thrive on arguments, but we grew sick of them, so we did it silently. The children interrupted our hostile silence. Our son said he wanted to go to a playground several blocks away. I said no, I didn't want him to go without his father or me. He wailed he wanted to go, he would go, and I never let him do anything. I yelled he wasn't going, and that was that. He yelled, "Please, I have to go, all the other kids get to go." As usual, I backed down. "Okay, go ahead, but be careful," I warned. I felt like I had lost. I always felt like I lost, with my kids and with my husband. No one ever listened to me, no one took me seriously. I didn't take me seriously. After supper, I washed dishes while my husband watched television. As usual, I work and you play. I worry and you relax. I care and you don't. You feel good, I hurt. Damn you. I walked through the living room several times, purposely blocking his view of the television and secretly flashing him hateful looks. He ignored me. After tiring of this, I promenaded into the living room, sighed, and said I was going outside to rake the yard. It's really the man's job, I explained, but I guess I'll have to do it. He said he'd do it later. I said later never came. I couldn't wait. I was embarrassed by the yard. Just forget it. I was used to doing everything, and I would do that, too. He said okay, he would forget it. I stormed outside and stomped around the yard. As tired as I was, bedtime came too early. Sleeping with my husband had become as strained as our waking moments. We would either not speak, each curling up on opposite sides of the bed as far away from each other as possible, or he would make attempts, as though everything were fine, to have sex with me. Either way, it was tense. If we turned our backs to each other, I would lie there with confused, desperate thoughts. If he tried to touch me, I froze. How could he expect me to make love to him? How could he touch me as though nothing had happened? Usually I pushed him away with a sharp, "No, I'm too tired." Sometimes I agreed. Occasionally I did it because I wanted to, but usually, if I had sex with him, it was because I felt obligated to take care of his sexual needs and guilty if I didn't. Either way, sex was psychologically and emotionally unsatisfying. But I told myself I didn't care. It didn't matter. Not really. Long ago, I had shut off my sexual desires. Long ago, I had shut off my need to give and receive love. I had frozen that part of me that felt and cared. I had to survive. I had expected so much of this marriage. I had so many dreams for us. None of them had come true. I had been tricked, betrayed. My home and family, the place and people who should have been warm, nurturing, a comfort, a haven of love, had become a trap, and I couldn't find the way out. Maybe I kept telling myself, it will get better. After all, the problems are his fault. He's an alcoholic. When he gets better, our marriage will get better. But I was beginning to wonder. He had been sober and attending Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months. He was getting better. I wasn't. Was his recovery really enough to make me happy? So far, his sobriety didn't appear to be changing the way I felt, which was, at age 32, dried up, used up, and brittle. What had happened to our love? What had happened to me? 1 month later, I began to suspect what I would soon learn was the truth. By then, the only thing that had changed was I felt worse. My life had ground to a halt. I wanted it to end. I had no hope that things would get better. I didn't even know what was wrong. I had no purpose, except to care for other people, and I wasn't doing a good job of that. I was stuck in the past and terrified of the future. God seemed to have abandoned me. I felt guilty all the time and wondered if I was going crazy. Something dreadful, something that I couldn't explain, had happened to me. It had snuck up on me and ruined my life. Somehow, I had been affected by his drinking, and the ways I had been affected had become my problems. It no longer mattered whose fault it was. I had lost control. I met Jessica at this point in her life. She was about to learn three fundamental ideas. Number one, she wasn't crazy. She was codependent. Alcoholism and other compulsive disorders are true family illnesses. The way the illness affects other family members is called codependency. Number two, once they have been affected, once it sets in, codependency takes on a life of its own. It is similar to catching pneumonia or picking up a destructive habit. Once you've got it, you've got it. Number three, if you want to get rid of it, you have to do something to make it go away. It doesn't matter whose fault it is. Your codependency becomes your problem. Solving your problems is your responsibility. If you're codependent, you need to find your own recovery or healing process. To begin that recovery, it helps to understand codependency and certain attitudes, feelings, and behaviors that often accompany it. It's also important to change some of these attitudes and behaviors
and understand what to expect as these changes occur. This book will search for those understandings and encourage those changes. I'm happy to say Jessica's story had a happy ending, or a new beginning. She got better. She started living her own life. I hope you do, too. Chapter 2 Other Stories. Ellen, an Al-Anon member, says, "When I say I'm codependent, I don't mean I'm a little bit codependent. I mean I'm really codependent. I don't marry men who stop for a few beers after work. I marry men who won't work." Maybe you identified with Jessica in the last chapter. Her story is an extreme example of codependency, but it's one I hear frequently. However, Jessica's experience is not the only type of codependency. There are as many variations of that story as there are codependents to tell them. Here are a few. Gerald, a handsome and personable man in his early 40s, calls himself a success in business but a failure in relationships with women. During high school and college, Gerald dated many women. He was popular and considered a good catch. However, after graduation, Gerald stunned his family and friends when he married Rita. Rita treated Gerald worse than any other woman he had dated. She acted cool and hostile toward Gerald and his friends, shared few interests with him, and didn't seem to care much for or about Gerald. 13 years later, the marriage ended in divorce when Gerald discovered some things he had suspected for years were true. Rita had been dating other men since they were married, and she was, and had been for some time, abusing alcohol and other drugs. Gerald was devastated. But after mourning for about 2 months, he fell wildly in love with another woman, who was a start-in-the-morning-and-drink-till-she-passes-out alcoholic. After spending several months worrying about her, trying to help her, trying to figure out what he was doing that caused her to drink, trying to control her drinking, and ultimately getting angry with her because she wouldn't stop drinking, Gerald terminated that relationship. Soon he met another woman, fell in love with her, and moved into her apartment. Within months, Gerald suspected she, too, was chemically dependent. Soon, Gerald began spending much of his time worrying about his girlfriend. He checked up on her, rummaged through her purse looking for pills or other evidence, and questioned her about her activities. Sometimes he simply denied she had a problem. During those times, he kept busy, tried to enjoy his time with his girlfriend, although he said he felt uneasy, and told himself, "It's just me. Something's wrong with me." During one of the many crises in his most recent relationship, when Gerald was temporarily jolted out of denial, he went to a chemical dependency counselor for advice. "I know I should end the relationship," Gerald said, "but I'm just not ready to let it go. We can talk about anything and everything together. We're such good friends. And I love her. Why? Why does this always happen to me? Give me a room full of women, and I'll fall in love with the one with the most problems, the one that will treat me the worst. Frankly, they're more of a challenge," Gerald confided. "If a woman treats me too well, it turns me off." Gerald considered himself a social drinker who had never had problems as a result of his drinking. Gerald told the counselor he had never used drugs. Gerald's brother, now in his late 40s, had been an alcoholic since he was a teenager. Gerald denied that either of his deceased parents was an alcoholic, but reluctantly admitted his dad may have drunk too much. The counselor suggested the alcoholism and excessive drinking in Gerald's immediate family may still be affecting him and his relationships. "How could their problems be affecting me?" he asked. "Dad has been dead for years, and I rarely see my brother." After a few counseling sessions, Gerald began to label himself codependent, but he wasn't sure exactly what that meant or what to do about it. When Gerald became less angry about the immediate problem in his relationship, he discontinued counseling. Gerald decided his girlfriend's problems with drugs weren't that bad. He became convinced his problems with women were due to bad luck. He said he hoped his luck would change someday. Is Gerald's problem bad luck, or is it codependency? Patty was in her mid-30s and had been married for 11 years when she sought help from a private therapist. She had three children, the youngest of whom had cerebral palsy. Patty had devoted her life to being a good wife and mother. She told her therapist she loved her children, didn't regret her decision to stay home and raise them, but hated her daily routine. Before her marriage, she had many friends and hobbies, worked as a nurse, and was interested in the world around her. However, in the years following the birth of her children, particularly her handicapped child, she had lost her enthusiasm for life. She had few friends, had gained over 80 pounds, didn't know what she was feeling, and if she did, felt guilty for feeling that way. She explained she had tried to stay active by helping her friends and doing volunteer work for various organizations, but her efforts usually resulted in feelings of ineffectiveness and resentment. She thought about returning to work, but she didn't because, "All I know is nursing, and I'm sick of taking care of people. My family and friends think I'm a tower of strength, good old dependable Patty, always there, always in control, always ready to help them. The truth is," Patty said, "I'm falling apart, very quietly but very certainly. I've been depressed for years. I can't shake it. I cry at the drop of a hat. I don't have any energy. I scream at the kids all the time. I don't have any interest in sex, at least not with my husband. I feel guilty all the time about everything. I even feel guilty about coming to see you," she told the counselor. "I should be able to solve my own problems. I should be able to just snap out of this. It's ridiculous to waste your time and my husband's money for my problems. Problems I'm probably imagining and blowing way out of proportion." "But I had to do something," Patty confessed. "Lately, I've been thinking about suicide. Of course," she added, "I'd never actually kill myself. Too many people need me. Too many people depend on me. I'd be letting them down. But I'm worried. I'm scared." The counselor learned Patty and her husband had children, the youngest with cerebral palsy. Patty also said before their marriage, her husband had problems with alcohol. During their marriage, he had drank less, had held the same job, and had been a good provider. But upon questioning, Patty told the counselor her husband had not attended Alcoholics Anonymous meetings or any other support group. Instead, he went on the wagon for months between weekend drinking binges. When he drank, he acted crazy. When he wasn't drinking, he was angry and hostile. "I don't know what's happened to him. He's not the man I married. What's even more frightening is, I don't know what's happening to me or who I am," Patty said. "It's difficult to explain exactly what the problem is. I don't understand it myself. There's no major problem I can point to and say, that's what's wrong. But it feels like I've lost myself. At times, I wonder if I'm going crazy. What's wrong with me?" Patty asked. "Maybe your husband is an alcoholic and your problems are caused by the family disease of alcoholism," the counselor suggested. "How could that be?" Patty asked. "My husband doesn't drink that often." The counselor dug into Patty's background. Patty talked with fondness about her parents and her two adult brothers. She came from a good family that was close and successful. The counselor dug deeper. Patty mentioned her father had attended Alcoholics Anonymous since she was a teenager. "Dad sobered up when I was in high school," she said. "I really love him, and I'm proud of him. But his drinking years were some pretty crazy years for our family." Not only was Patty married to someone who is probably an alcoholic, she is what is now called an adult child of an alcoholic. The entire family had been affected by the family disease of alcoholism. Her dad stopped drinking. Her mother went to Al-Anon. Family life improved. But Patty, too, had been affected. Was she expected to magically overcome the way she had been affected just because the drinking stopped? Instead of additional counseling sessions, Patty's counselor referred Patty to a self-esteem course and an assertiveness class. The counselor also recommended Patty attend Al-Anon meetings or Adult Children of Alcoholics meetings, which are self-help groups based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Patty followed the counselor's advice. She didn't find an overnight cure, but as the months passed, she found herself making decisions with greater ease, feeling and expressing her feelings, saying what she thought, paying attention to her needs, and feeling less guilty. She became more tolerant of herself and her daily routine. Gradually, her depression lifted. She cried less and laughed more. Her energy and enthusiasm for life returned. Incidentally, with no prodding from Patty, her husband joined Alcoholics Anonymous. He became less hostile, and their marriage began to improve. The point here is Patty gained control of her life. Her life started working. Now, if you ask Patty what her problem is or was, she will answer, "I'm codependent." Clients who seek help from mental health and chemical dependency agencies are not the only people who suffer from codependency. Randall was a chemical dependency counselor and a recovering alcoholic with several years of sobriety when he found himself having troubles. Randall was also an adult child of an alcoholic. His father and three brothers were alcoholics. An intelligent, sensitive man who enjoyed his work, Randall's problem was his leisure time. He spent most of it worrying about, obsessed with, other people and their problems. Sometimes he tried to untangle messes alcoholics created. Other times he felt angry with the alcoholics for creating the messes he felt obligated to clean up. Sometimes he felt upset because people, not necessarily alcoholics, behaved in particular ways. He ranted, felt guilty, sorry, and used by people. Rarely, however, did he feel close to them. Rarely did he have fun. For many years, Randall believed his duty was to worry about people and get involved in their problems. He called his behavior kindness, concern, love, and sometimes righteous indignation. Now, after getting help for his problem, he calls it codependency. Sometimes codependent behavior becomes inextricably entangled with being a good wife, mother, husband, brother, or Christian. Now in her 40s, Marlis is an attractive woman, when she takes care of herself. Most of the time, however, she's busy taking care of her 5 children and her husband, who is a recovering alcoholic. She devoted her life to making them happy, but she didn't succeed. Usually, she feels angry and unappreciated for her efforts, and her family feels angry at her. She has sex with her husband whenever he wants, regardless of how she feels. She spends too much of the family's budget on toys and clothing for the children, whatever they want. She chauffeurs, reads to, cooks for, cleans for, cuddles and coddles those around her, but nobody gives to her. Most of the time, they don't even say thank you. Marlis resents her constant giving to people in her life. She resents how her family and their needs control her life. She chose nursing as her profession, and she often resents that. "But I feel guilty when I don't do what's asked of me. I feel guilty when I don't live up to my standards for a wife and mother. I feel guilty when I don't live up to other people's standards for me. I just plain feel guilty," she said. "In fact," she added, "I schedule my day, my priorities, according to guilt." Does endlessly taking care of other people, resenting it, and expecting nothing in return mean Marlis is a good wife and mother? Or could it mean Marlis is codependent? Alcoholism, or chemical dependency, is not the only family problem that can create a codependent person. Alyssa, the mother of 2 teenagers, worked part-time at a mental health organization when she went to a family counselor. She had previously gone to many family counselors in her search for help. She went to counseling because her oldest child, a 14-year-old boy, was constantly causing problems. He ran away, broke curfew, skipped school, disobeyed other family rules, and generally did whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted. "This child," Alyssa told the counselor,
is driving me crazy. She meant it. She was worried sick. Some days, she was so depressed and troubled she couldn't get out of bed. Alyssa had tried everything she could think of to help this child. She'd placed him in treatment 3 times, put him in 2 different foster homes, and dragged the whole family from counselor to counselor. Alyssa had tried other techniques, too. She had threatened, cried, hollered, and begged. She had gotten tough and called the police on him. She had tried gentleness and forgiveness. She even tried acting like he hadn't done the inappropriate things he had done. She had locked him out, and she had traveled halfway across the state to bring him home after he ran away. Although her efforts hadn't helped her child, Alyssa was obsessed with finding and doing the one thing that would make him see the errors of his ways and help him change. "Why," she asked the counselor, "is he doing this to me? He's running and ruining my life." The counselor agreed the problem with Alyssa's son was painful, upsetting, and required action. But the counselor also said the problem didn't have to run and ruin Alyssa's life. "You haven't been able to control your son, but you can gain control of yourself," he said. "You can deal with your own codependency." Cheryl also labels herself codependent. Shortly after marrying the man of her dreams, she found herself in a nightmare. Her husband, she learned, was a sex addict. In his case, that meant he couldn't control his urges to indulge in pornography. He was compulsively drawn into affairs with other women, and, as Cheryl put it, God only knows what and who else. She learned her husband was a sex addict 1 week after their wedding, when she discovered him in bed with another woman. Cheryl's first response was panic. Then she got angry. Then she felt concern for her husband and his problem. Her friends advised her to leave him, but she decided to stay in the marriage. He needed help. He needed her. Maybe he would change. Besides, she wasn't ready to lose her dream of that rosy future they would have together. Her husband joined Sex Addicts Anonymous, a 12-step self-help group similar to Alcoholics Anonymous. Cheryl refused to join COSA, similar to Al-Anon, for family members of sex addicts. She didn't want to go public with her problem. She didn't even want to discuss it privately. Over a period of months, Cheryl, a successful fashion model, found herself accepting fewer work assignments, turning down evenings out with friends, and sticking closer to home. She wanted to answer the telephone in case women called for her husband. She wanted to be home to see her husband when he left the house and returned. She wanted to see what he looked like, how he acted, and how he talked. She wanted to know exactly what he was doing and with whom he was doing it. She often called his SA sponsor to complain, to report, and to inquire about her husband's progress. She refused, she said, to be tricked and deceived again. Gradually, she alienated herself from her friends and activities. She was too worried to work. She was too ashamed to talk to her friends. Her husband had several more affairs. Her friends were frustrated with her for staying with him and constantly whining about how terrible it was to be his wife. "I couldn't stand the sight of my husband. I had nothing but contempt for him. Yet I couldn't bring myself to leave him," Cheryl reported later. "I couldn't make myself do much of anything except worry and check up on him. My turning point was the night I chased him with a butcher knife," Cheryl said. "It was my lowest point. I was running through the house, screaming and raving, when I suddenly became aware, for the first time, of me. I had gone mad. I was crazy, completely out of control. And he just stood there, calmly looking at me. I knew then I had to do something to get help for me." Cheryl joined COSA shortly after that incident. It was at those meetings that she began to label herself and her loss of control as codependency. Cheryl is now separated from her husband and seeking a divorce. She is also feeling better about herself. Although the preceding examples have been dramatic, codependency doesn't necessarily have to be so intense, and it doesn't always involve experiences with deeply troubled people. Kristen is married, has two young children, and knows of no alcoholism or compulsive disorders in her immediate or extended family. Yet, she calls herself codependent. Her problem, she says, is that other people's moods control her emotions. She, in turn, tries to control their feelings. If my husband is happy, and I feel responsible for that, then I'm happy. If he's upset, I feel responsible for that, too. I'm anxious, uncomfortable, and upset until he feels better. I try to make him feel better. I feel guilty if I can't, and he gets angry with me for trying. And it's not only with him that I behave codependently, she added. It's with everyone, my parents, my children, guests in my home. Somehow, I just seem to lose myself in other people. I get enmeshed in them. I'd like to do something about it, this thing called codependency, before it gets any worse. I'm not terribly unhappy, she said, but I'd like to learn how to relax and start enjoying myself and other people. A minister summarized the condition this way. Some people are really codependent, and some of us are just a little bit codependent. I chose the preceding examples because they're interesting and represent a variety of experiences. They also illuminate a point that needs to be made. No single example illustrates the typical codependent or his or her experience. Codependency is complex. People are complex. Each person is unique, and each person's situation is different. Some people have extremely painful and debilitating experiences with codependency. Others don't, and may be only mildly affected. Sometimes codependency is a person's response to another person's alcoholism. Sometimes it isn't. Each codependent has a unique experience born from his or her circumstances, history, and personality. Yet, a common thread runs through all stories of codependency. It involves our responses and reactions to people around us. It involves our relationships with other people, whether they are alcoholics, gamblers, sex addicts, overeaters, or normal people. Codependency involves the effects these people have on us and how we, in turn, try to affect them. As Al-Anon members say, identify, don't compare. Activity. Number one, did you identify with any people in this chapter? What helped you think of yourself? Which relationships did it bring to mind? Why? Number two, you might find it helpful to buy a large notebook and record your responses to these activities. You can also write down other thoughts and feelings you have as you read this book. Chapter 3. Codependency. Colette Dowling says, "Relationships are like a dance, with visible energy racing back and forth between the partners. Some relationships are the slow, dark dance of death." Up to this point, I've been using the words codependent and codependency as lucid terms. However, the definitions of these words remain vague. The definition of chemical dependency means being dependent, psychologically and/or physically, on alcohol or other drugs. Overeating and gambling are also words that bring specific ideas to mind. But what is codependency? The obvious definition would be being a partner in dependency. This definition is close to the truth, but still unclear. It brings no specific image to mind. Codependency is part of treatment-centered jargon, professional slang that's probably unintelligible to people outside that profession, and gibberish to some inside the trade. Jargon may or may not mean anything in particular. Jargon may mean different things to different people, or people may sense what a term means but not be able to clearly define it because it's never been clearly defined. Those are some of the problems I've encountered with researching and attempting to define codependency and codependent.
Many people haven't heard the terms. Others, who are familiar with the words, can't define them. If they can, each definition is different. Or people define the words by using more jargon. To complicate matters, I can't find the words in any dictionaries. My computer keeps tagging the words as misspelled, trying to convince me they're not words. Yet, codependency does mean something in particular, something particularly important to me and millions of people. Let's get rid of the jargon and look at that meaning. What's codependency? I have heard and read many definitions of codependency. In an article from the book Codependency, An Emerging Issue, Robert Subbe wrote, codependency is an emotional, psychological, and behavioral condition that develops as a result of an individual's prolonged exposure to and practice of a set of oppressive rules. Rules which prevent the open expression of feeling as well as the direct discussion of personal and interpersonal problems. Ernie Larson, another codependency specialist and a pioneer in that field, defines codependency as those self-defeating, learned behaviors or character defects that result in a diminished capacity to initiate or to participate in loving relationships. Some less professional definitions follow. Codependency means, said one woman, that I'm a caretaker. Being codependent means I'm married to an alcoholic, responded one woman. It also means I need to go to Al-Anon. Codependency, replied another, means I'm up to my elbows in alcoholics. It means I'm always looking for someone to glob onto. Codependency? It means I know any man I'm attracted to, fall in love with, or marry will be chemically dependent or have some other equally serious problem. Codependency, explained one person, is knowing all your relationships will either go on and on the same way, painfully, or end the same way, disastrously, or both. There are almost as many definitions of codependency as there are experiences that represent it. In desperation, or perhaps enlightenment, some therapists have proclaimed, codependency is anything and everyone is codependent. So, who's got the inside story? Which definition is accurate? A brief history of codependency will help answer this question. A brief history. The word codependency appeared on the treatment scene in the late 70s. I don't know who discovered it. Although several people may claim to have done so, the word emerged simultaneously in several different treatment centers in Minnesota, according to information from the office of Sandra Smalley, CCDP, a licensed psychologist and a leader in the codependency field. Maybe Minnesota, the heartland of chemical dependency treatment and 12-step programs for compulsive disorders, discovered it. Robert Subbe and John Friel, in an article from the book Codependency, An Emerging Issue, wrote, originally, it was used to describe the person or persons whose lives were affected as a result of their being involved with someone who is chemically dependent. The codependent spouse or child or lover of someone who is chemically dependent was seen as having developed a pattern of coping with life that was not healthy as a reaction to someone else's drug or alcohol abuse. It was a new name for an old game. Professionals had long suspected something peculiar happened to people who were closely involved with chemically dependent people. Some research had been done on the subject, indicating a physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual condition similar to alcoholism seemed to appear in many non-alcoholic or non-chemically dependent people who were close to an alcoholic. Words, more jargon, which would later become synonymous for codependent, surfaced to describe this phenomenon: co-alcoholic, non-alcoholic, para-alcoholic. Codependents certainly felt the effects of codependency long before the word was coined. In the 1940s, after the birth of Alcoholics Anonymous, a group of people, primarily wives of alcoholics, formed self-help support groups to deal with the ways their spouse's alcoholism affected them. They didn't know they would later be called codependents. They did know they had been directly affected by their mate's alcoholism. And they were envious that alcoholics had a 12-step program to recover through. The wives also wanted a program. So they used the AA 12-step program, revised the AA 12 traditions, changed its name to Al-Anon, and it worked. Millions of people have since benefited from Al-Anon. The basic thought then, and in 1979 when the word codependency emerged, was codependents, co-alcoholics or para-alcoholics, were people whose lives had become unmanageable as a result of living in a committed relationship with an alcoholic. However, the definition for codependency has expanded since then. Professionals began to better understand the effects of the chemically dependent person on the family, and the effects of the family on the chemically dependent person. Professionals began to identify other problems, such as overeating and undereating, gambling, and certain sexual behaviors. These compulsive disorders paralleled the compulsive disorder or illness of alcoholism. Professionals also began to notice many people in close relationships with these compulsive people developed patterns of reacting and coping that resembled the coping patterns of people in relationships with alcoholics. Something peculiar had happened to these families, too. As professionals began to understand codependency better, more groups of people appeared to have it. Adult children of alcoholics, people in relationships with emotionally or mentally disturbed persons, people in relationships with chronically ill people, parents of children with behavior problems, people in relationships with irresponsible people, professionals, nurses, social workers, and others in helping occupations. Even recovering alcoholics and addicts noticed they were codependent and perhaps had been long before becoming chemically dependent. Codependence started cropping up everywhere.
This ends Disc 1. Codependent No More. Disc 2.
When a codependent discontinued his or her relationship with a troubled person, the codependent frequently sought another troubled person and repeated the codependent behaviors with that new person. These behaviors, or coping mechanisms, seemed to prevail throughout the codependent's life, if that person didn't change these behaviors. Was it safe to assume codependency was triggered through relationships with people who have serious illnesses, behavior problems, or destructive compulsive disorders? Alcoholism in the family helped create codependency, but many other circumstances seem to produce it also. One fairly common denominator was having a relationship, personally or professionally, with troubled, needy, or dependent people. But a second, more common denominator seemed to be the unwritten, silent rules that usually develop in the immediate family and set the pace for relationships. These rules prohibit discussion about problems, open expression of feelings, direct, honest communication, realistic expectations such as being human, vulnerable, or imperfect, selfishness, trust in other people and oneself, playing and having fun, and rocking the delicately balanced family canoe through growth or change, however healthy and beneficial that movement might be. These rules are common to alcoholic family systems, but can emerge in other families too. Now I return to an earlier question. Which definition of codependency is accurate? They all are. Some describe the cause, some the effects, some the overall condition, some the symptoms, some the patterns, and some the pain. Codependency either meant or has come to mean all the definitions listed earlier. I'm not trying to confuse you. Codependency has a fuzzy definition because it is a gray, fuzzy condition. It is complex, theoretical, and difficult to completely define in one or two sentences. Why all this fuss about a definition? Because I'm going to attempt the difficult. Define codependent in one sentence. And I want you to see the broader picture before I show you the narrower one. I hope this approach might help you identify codependency in yourself, if that identification is appropriate. Defining the problem is important because it helps determine the solution. Here, the solution is vital. It means feeling better. It means recovery.